this week on What's Going On with Earl Ingram, we're joined by guest Joyce Mallory from the Milwaukee Public School System. She's here to discuss how restoring values, accountability, and trust within Milwaukee schools can pave the way for a brighter future for our students. From improving student performance to ensuring financial transparency, Joyce shares how the district is working hard to rebuild stability, strengthen leadership, and bring MPS back to its core mission of empowering every child to succeed. Tune in to What's Going On with Earl Ingram as Joyce Mallory from the Milwaukee Public School System shares her insights on these important topics. Don't miss it, airing this week on all streaming platforms. Follow us on civicmedia.us or wherever you follow your podcast. And please remember to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss your favorite episode.
Welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. You know, I'm always thrilled to have dialogue and conversation with this dear sister who's been at the vanguard of fighting for justice and rights in her life and in our community. And, you know, today is no different. We're going to continue along the lines that we've been doing now. This is the third of many different conversations we're going to be having about education, especially restoring Milwaukee Public Schools financial accountability, transparency, and improving student performances. Welcome back a former school board member of Milwaukee Public Schools, Ms. Joyce Mallory. Good morning to you, my friend. How you doing?
Good morning, Earl. Nice to be back with you this sunny Monday in our hometown.
Yeah, you know, before we get into all the things that we're going to be getting into education, I have to ask you about your feelings about now the government trying to strike down the Voting Rights Act. Just the outrage that this is even something that could even be considered. Mm-hmm. And after all the work that was put in, and then to turn around and say, well, this is discriminatory to other people, meaning to white people, your thoughts?
Well, if we had had the right to vote when slavery ended, then we wouldn't have this problem, would we?
No.
But
no.
This is another attempt to silence the voice and the power of people of color so that those who've always had the power can continue to rule and govern and tell us what to do. All of what we're seeing playing out on the streets and in cities where there are large communities of color, this is intentional. It is intentional discrimination, persecution, prosecution, and illegal against people of color who are citizens of this country, who the Constitution guaranteed each person has a vote. And they want to take that vote away. They took it away when we were didn't have the right to vote through intimidation, through hang-ins, through burning down churches where we gathered to talk about how we could improve conditions in our community and the right to vote. Megar Evers got killed in his driveway in Jackson, Mississippi, working for the right to vote. And now in 2025, we are saying that Megar's blood, sweat, and tears on that driveway didn't matter, and that there is still no effort to suppress our vote and to keep us from voting. Yeah, this is clearly a violation of our constitutional rights, and we have to push back. I think Saturday proved that people are not complacent, and so I want to issue a challenge to every one of us in Milwaukee that your vote matters. And that you need to make sure when elections come, local, national, and otherwise, every time the polls are open, you need to march there and make sure you have the right to vote. I grew up in a state where a majority of the blacks could not vote, were scared to vote. And when we got the right to vote, some to this day in Mississippi are still scared to go vote.
You know, Jolly, Joyce, the poll taxes and all of those things that you and I, as we were young people, we saw those things happen to those before us. And what bothers me is that as we're watching these things resurface, you know, there was an organized effort by leaders during your and my generation who fought and made sure that the Voting Rights Act became a reality. It didn't happen, you know, because somebody wished it to happen. It happened because we were organized and there were people who realized the importance of collectiveness. I was a part of the rally in Milwaukee this past Saturday. As a matter of fact, I was the MC of the rally here in Milwaukee, 15,000 people. And to see those people organize and sending a message that there aren't any kings, we need to be organizing, looking at them striking down the Voting Rights Act. Black people all over this country should be up in arms. And we have to begin by educating our youth just what this is. They have no idea. And so while they're engaged in many other things, the lack of them being educated, and in many instances not their fault, on what transpired and where we are today and what they're going to face, you know, we've got to do a job to get them organized and understanding what will happen if they strike down the Voting Rights Act. But we also need to get them to understand why they should vote. Many of the younger people in our community don't want to vote. They don't see voting as something that's going to change their lives, but couldn't be further from the truth, could it?
I mean, just today, right now with the shutdown, they have laid off all the staff. I'll just take this example. Special education funds that come into the district for children who have speech delays, who go to Gensland School every day in a wheelchair, and they receive services. These funds are not available. And disproportionately, our children are fall in that category because a lot of them have been mislabeled. And I kind of thought about that today. We have too many of our children being labeled early at 4 and 5 years old, and that should never happen. At 4 and 5, children are still developing, and we need to allow them to develop. Unless they have hearing, or speech,
some physical,
or some other real physical disability, they should never be diagnosed and put in a special education class until all measures to get them to be able to learn to their potential has been exhausted, and then you use that as the last resort. When I was at Malaika, I got a lot of requests to fill out those forms, and I never did. And a colleague of mine said, that's a federal form, you must fill it out. I said, well, somebody's gonna have to come here and make me do it because I'm not gonna sign it. For the children who needed it, I had a little boy whose mother and father were murdered, and he lost his speech. He didn't talk after that. He was so traumatized. So we had him diagnosed. MPS came to Malaika. The speech therapist came. And after working with him a year, and he was in a stable environment, he started talking again. And so that's the interventions you need. You don't need some of these others. But the loss of funding is all about if 10%, and I'm going to use this example, if 12% more African Americans had voted in the last Senate race, Mandela Barnes would be our senator. But they didn't vote. And the result of that is
Ron Johnson.
That Johnson got reelected, and he doesn't represent our interests. He's never going to represent our interests. Whatever he does is just he's still denying that the January 6th wasn't an insurrection. So what is he going to do on our behalf? So you young people have to understand that. The lynchings, that the three young people who were in Mississippi going out trying to get people to register to vote were murdered and killed by white supremacists, buried in a shallow grave, and as if they were collateral damage on the highway. That's what they thought about those three young men, two of whom were black and one was white. So if you think somebody's going to give you something, if you think there is a lot of empathy for you in terms of your rights, you have to understand that has never been the case. And I would recommend everybody watch the Andrew Young documentary that just came out. So you will see the kind of sacrifice, the kind of work that they did on the ground, they were fearful for their lives, but they went out every day doing it. I remember at Tougaloo, I went to Hattiesburg to do doors to try to get people to vote in 1967, where black people were scared. The all of the Klansmen and the violence that had occurred had us fearful to go and exercise our right to vote. Even after the Voting Rights Act was passed, people were still afraid. So if you think things are different and better because you can walk around here freely every day, you're going to find out that there are guardrails are being put in place, that you are being monitored, that people know where you are and who you are, especially if you get booked into a jail, they are tracking you forever. Your footprint is going to be out there. So you need to understand that people use that against you, even though you might have done your time, you might have reformed yourself, that is still a legacy you're going to have around your, when it says a millstone in the Bible, that's one of the millstones that you can avoid. So be real clear that if you're 18 years old, you need to have your name on the voter registration list in Milwaukee County. Take your student ID or your Wisconsin ID, take yourself and get registered. I will say Milwaukee Public Schools should allow every 18-year-old in the district to vote, to register to vote in school. That would be that should be a good civic education opportunity across all schools, all high schools. Seniors, there are young people turning 18 every day in a high school in this city and in this state, and they should be able to register to vote.
You know, Joyce, we're talking about education, and we're going to get into again our subject matter, but I would be remiss if we didn't delve a little deeper into what we're talking about right now, because there's a reason that the Republicans and Donald Trump want to do away with history. They want to change and rearrange what's going on at the Smithsonian's. They want to basically undo, you know, what transpired and how we were treated. And so the only place, or the one place that, you know, that history can be taught is in the schools. It's not going to be taught anywhere else. You know, social media is not going to teach that, right? And so we have young people who spend so much time on social media getting messages, but they aren't getting messages about things like we're talking about right now that will shape their futures. And
I'm sorry,
go ahead.
I think the African American, I'm not going to put all the responsibility on the schools and other institutions. I think civic education and history should be taught accurately and to reflect what has happened in this country since its beginning. And it should be taught in a way that all children, beginning in elementary school, understand some of the challenges that we face, how we face them, how we've lived through them, the kinds of positive actions, the violence that was associated with doing that. All of that should be taught in schools in a way that it includes all of it, because to exclude it or to brush over it or to minimize it, we do everyone a disservice, both children of color and white students as well. Everybody should get the same message, same understanding of history, so that he or she can make their own decisions about what is right and wrong, and to have a perspective, because if we're going to stop some of this hate and bigotry, we have to help young people at an early age start to develop a lens that is different than what they might see in their individual communities as well. And the other, I will say, it's on the African American institutions as well, and community organizations, churches, all of us, because when I was growing up, that's all we had. I didn't have anybody else to go to. So I had to rely on my mother. I had to rely on my own family history. So if we start by saying the things that have happened, if we just take the commandos, the marches that we did here in Milwaukee, you could help young people connect. That was an activist group that was teenagers, basically, teenagers, young adults, who took it upon themselves through the NAACP Youth Council that there was something useful they could do and something they could get out there and march peacefully. They could bring attention to segregated housing, and they were able to get results as a result of their participation.
You know, Valerie, it shaped me. Mallory,
yeah,
Joyce.
Yeah,
I mean, it shaped me. That's I am who I am. I fight the battles that I fight now, Joyce, because I was blessed to be born during that time.
Yeah, I mean, you've got McKinney there. You know, a lot of them have passed on, and a lot of them are still here, and nobody knows them. We don't lift them up as examples of a positive way that we could get young people to engage and be active and see results in their community. But those young people were willing to put their lives on the line, because when they crossed Wisconsin Avenue and went to the South Side, you know, people got through rocks at them, bottles, sticks. It wasn't an easy march. They endured all of that. So every community in America has stories like that. And so we need to figure out, you know, you can figure out how to move ahead by looking back sometimes. When you look back at the things that we were able to get done, then and the NAACP led that. So we need somebody else to step up and say, we are going to make sure that everybody votes. And Souls to the Polls, I want to give a big shout out to Reverend Greg. He does tremendous work. I remember when he started, and in spite of his own personal health challenges, he's never given up, and he's gotten a lot of young people are involved and engaged. So I'll shout him out as another good example of what can be done and is being done to make sure that there's increased awareness. And if some elder in every family who's suffered through segregation and knows the vestige of segregation would take it upon themselves to make sure everybody in their family, when they turn 18, rather than having a big party and balloons, that you march them somewhere to get registered to vote, and then you celebrate.
I concur. Let's get into, again, this edict that you have written. This is the third segment of it, in addressing the ills, financial problems with a district that 30 years ago you were very much involved in, especially from the perspective of a school board member. Restructuring Milwaukee Public Schools financial management functions. Now, anybody who, you know, has been around over the last 10 years and has been lucid understands the duress that Milwaukee Public Schools has been under. Now, it's probably been longer than 10 years, but it came to surface some 10 years ago just how bad a condition the district was in. So, You came up with this plan, and right now we'll go into restructuring Milwaukee Public Schools financial management functions, restore the functions of the previous business manager position to the chief.
I think we covered those last week.
Yeah, we did. Okay. Yeah. Let's go. Yeah. Here we are. Recommendations to improve functioning of the Board of School Directors. If ever there was one that is important, it is this one. They're all important, but this one especially. Now, improve functioning of the Board of School Directors. What do you mean by that?
Well, it appears that because of what happened to the district with regard to its finances, not being in compliance, not being able to submit financial records on time, and the loss of Head Start and loss of some other funding from the state, that it appeared to me that the board didn't appear to be aware. And if they were aware, they certainly didn't act on it, didn't take any actions to make sure that the district was in compliance and that its financial
House position was in order.
Was not being compromised or would lead to the loss of funding. So it is the board's responsibility. The board has fiduciary responsibility for everything that happens in the district. If the board, if a lawsuit is brought, it is the board who is sued. The board's name is there first, and maybe the superintendent or an individual person, but you can't sue the individual administrators. It's the board because they have financial responsibility. And if you look at that, then the board should be aware of all of its fiduciary responsibilities across all of the school district's operations. Whether it's the buildings, whether it's insurance, are you paying your insurance on time? Are you submitting your federal funding? You got a lot of sources of revenue. You got state, you got federal, and you got district funds. And so those funds, the categorization of those funds should be so that you can see where they come from, what do they support in the district, how much is it, when is reporting requirements? If you have to report when you get grants and federal funding, you have to submit. There are other things you need to be in compliance with as well with regard to those funds. And so it's the board through its committees. The work is done at the committee level. And so the board should have been getting reports, financial reports and information transmitted to them that helps them understand this is where we are. And if there were any concerns, turnover in staff, loss of talent, loss of institutional knowledge. When you change people all the time, you lose institutional knowledge. So that was the board's responsibility, is to ask the tough questions and to ask for information so that they can take corrective action or direct the superintendent and the administrators to make sure that the district is in compliance and stays in compliance. And so that means understanding your roles, being real clear. When you are elected to the board, you should get a good orientation in terms of your role and responsibility, what committees you're serving on, what is the duties and responsibilities of those committees, what kinds of things should you expect to receive as a result of that, and then take action. You can get a schedule. You have to do a budget. You meet every month. You have to approve recommendations for staff comes to the board. You review those. The operations, the building. Somebody should have known lead was in the building. When was the last time there was the facilities head of facilities did an audit? There was a law passed about a lead in water, for example. And I was on the Charter School Review Committee, and it came to us. And so immediately we sent out communication to all of the 8 charter schools at that time to say, this is a new city ordinance. You must have all of your water must be tested. All of your drinking fountains need to be tested. And here, and you need to be in compliance. And someone went out and made sure that, and the schools were responsible for doing that and sending us a report to make sure they were in compliance. When we didn't hear, the staff person for the committee went out and met with the schools and to see and to get a date certain when they would be in compliance. MPS should have been doing the same thing. You know, you have kids in old buildings, and so just like we tested for asbestos and remediated a lot of that, water should have been done the same way, and that should have been done. Back in my day, we had a buildings and facilities committee, and that should have been coming to a committee.
Well, Joyce, you just touched on a myriad of things, and when you talk about the school board, they're not just the recent school board. The issues and the problems that Milwaukee Public Schools has faced and continue to face, it's been a contingent of different school boards that basically failed in their fiduciary responsibilities all along the way. And so it just continued because, again, when you talked about the lead paint remediation that took place, there was a plan in place when you were on the school board, and they followed through with that. They knew that those buildings were old, and there was a plan to address those things. But along the way, all those things fell by the wayside, not just with dealing with the paint remediation, but many other aspects of, as you stated, once different boards came on to replace the prior boards. What it led to was to point out to many people that there should be a process that once a board person is no longer there, that when the new board person comes in, that there needs to be some training. Yes. There needs to be somebody to, and they shouldn't just be left alone. Okay, you won, now you're on the board, and now all this information that is not easy. There has to be a process.
Yeah, and back when I was on the board, the secretary business manager was the person who sat down on the business side, all the operations side right. of the district. And then the superintendent would sit down with the new incoming board person and talk about all of the educational programs and all of that. So you know, you were able to get a good basic understanding of how the district operated, how its functions, your responsibility and better understanding your role and responsibility and all of that, which is policy. Our job was to make policy, was to make sure we were in compliance. And so if you have someone with that institutional knowledge, it's really important. That's why we have staggered elections, so that not everybody goes off at the same time, because then you lose institutional knowledge. And then this is what could potentially happen when all of the seats turn over. But again, if I'm a board member, I think there's also an individual responsibility on the part of members who are elected to also educate themselves. And if somebody didn't sit down with you or didn't offer to do that, then you should be asking, because it is their responsibility to explain all of that to you and make sure you understand. When you get your information, if you don't understand it, call, ask the tough questions. And get an understanding. As a board member, you should be talking to and visiting each school in your district. You should know who your principals are, because I got calls every day from a parent or someone complaining about something, and I needed to know who I needed to have a relationship with that principal. I needed to be able to call him or her. I would say to the parent, I listened to their complaint, and I would say to them, now I've heard your side. I also now have to call the school and ask the principal what happened, so that I can have good information, and then I'll get back to you and give you a recommendation or a suggestion. That's how I did it. I went to my schools. I knew because I was on budget committee and chaired budget, I would go to say, what concerns do you have? What needs do you have? All of that. And just show up to see what's going on and be available to parents. Parents are going to call you. I got calls all the time. I always tried to get, I had a notebook by my phone. I could write down names and numbers. If I wasn't there, my son would, once he got big enough, he could take the calls. But knowing your role, and you're going to get a lot of noise. You're going to get a lot of people calling, vote like this, vote like that, vote this way, do this, do that. You listen to all of that, but you use data and information, and you talk at the school, and you get information from the school level and from subject matter experts, and you use all of that. And based on your principles, your values, and what you believe as a board member, your actions should align with all of that, and not take marching orders from someone who only has one perspective or have self-interest.
You know, George, 30 years ago, my son was in Milwaukee Public Schools, and I remember the fiery board meetings where the community would come in, and I remember the board at least hearing what would be considered complaints about what was going on, and they didn't take it personally. They didn't feel like it was an attack. The recent boards, if a parent stands up and has some concerns, the board members get thin-skinned. Let's talk a little bit about whether or not, if you're a board member, you should be able to hear what parents and taxpayers have to say? Is that part of the job?
Oh, of course. I mean, when you agree, you're going to, I mean, you have to be firm enough and strong enough in who you are and what you stand for to be able to listen, because you get information to help you make a good decision. And if you're going to shut out all of that, if you're going to only have one position and can't be moved off it after people tell you, give you information and share with you another perspective or another viewpoint, then you shouldn't be on the board. First of all, I want to say it is the board's president duty and responsibility to make sure there is always good decorum at a meeting. He or she sets that tone by asking the audience to be respectful. We're going to listen to you, but you need to also show respect and decorum so that everyone can be heard.
So you're talking about Robert's Rules of Order. That's basically what you're talking about.
It's Robert's Rules of Order. I mean, I had that book in my desk, and that's where it stayed for the 10 years I was there. Because we operated on a belief that we're going to show, even if I disagree with you, I'm going to still respect you and give you an opportunity to be heard. And I want you to do the same to me. I want you to show me the same courtesy and decorum that I'm showing to you. And we had, back then, we would let people speak a minimum of 5 minutes of most of the time. So people could, you know, and sometimes we let people go. During budget time, we kind of stayed to that because so many people wanted to talk. But it is the board as a whole who needs to make sure that they are not sitting there making faces and their body language is like, why don't you sit down and go away?
Yes.
That is not respectful. That is not why you were elected. These are all taxpayers, parents. They are stakeholders in the education, and there should be a partnership between the schools and the families and parents and the community where their students live. And so having, you know, what I always say, I grew thick skin when I was on the board, because if I hadn't, I probably would have got knocked off the first night that I went to a meeting.
You know,
but
Joyce,
you sit there and you listen, and then, because a lot of times you'll hear something, and a lot of our teachers back in the day came and, you know, and shared information as well. But you cannot disrespect people and expect that they are going to support you or be kind and respectful back. It's the board's responsibility to sit there and listen. I don't care how mean-spirited it might sound sometimes, it is still your responsibility to sit there and listen and make sure that everyone has an opportunity to be heard. And if you set the right decorum, you should be able to have orderly meetings.
You know, Joyce, I also would say that sometimes in the district they fail to understand that the taxpayers are their employers.
Well, the taxpayers who live in each of the districts are, when they voted for you, they voted for you because you told them you had some beliefs and positions about education. You sent them information and had some nice little talking points on it that convinced them that maybe you do know what you are talking about and you're willing to work on behalf of their children's interests. And then when you get there sometimes and you see how challenging it is, or if someone else has given you all the campaign money, you decide that you're going to ignore what people say and you're going to do something different that may or may not be in the best interest of the students who you represent. And just because you live in a district, it doesn't mean your responsibility is to make good policy decisions on all of the children who live in who go to Milwaukee Public Schools. You vote individually, but what you vote and how you vote should benefit all children in the district equitably.
So Joyce, board should set annual strategic goals to guide the development of the annual budget and direct the superintendent and chief of board governance to develop a budget that reflects these goals. I mean, that's pretty involved, and you can't fake your way through something like that. You have to have internal knowledge on the inner workings of budgets in order to be able to make that a truism.
Right. I think what we did was, you know, we focused a lot on early childhood, on reading. I think I mentioned last time we set the goal of all children would take algebra by right. eighth grade, because we wanted kids to be able to do it well. And once they got to ninth grade, at least pre-algebra if they didn't take algebra. It is the board responsibility. All boards have a responsibility to set the strategic direction for their organizations. And so annually, we would have a strategic planning meeting with the board. We'd bring in some of the administrators, and they would talk about some of the challenges that needed to be addressed. But we sift through all of that, and we always had a facilitator to help us, guide us through that process. And once we did that, we wasn't trying to have 20 strategic goals. We narrowed it down so that it was manageable and achievable, and set some measures that we could evaluate whether those things were being achieved or not. And so then you look at your budget and does that align? If we want to put more money behind kids kindergarten through third grade, then what is the per pupil cost at elementary? What is the per pupil cost at middle and then high school? What are the additional supports that children need to be able to do that? And I'll take reading as an example. To me, I think it's in that document. I think that one of the most single fundamental goals this district should have is that all children will be able to read proficiently by third grade. And that's all children. And so if that is a goal, and it appears that the new superintendent is focusing on reading, and I applaud her for that, then your budget needs to reflect investments that will help teachers and support staff be able to achieve that goal. What is the class size in K-5? What is the class size in first grade? What is the class size in second grade? What is the class size in third grade? What are the additional supports? What is the reading curriculum? Is it a curriculum that's really going to be able to help kids read proficiently at third grade? And is that curriculum going to be in place from K-4 to third grade, or somebody's going to change it in midstream and then you got to start over? That is one of the frustrations that I've heard repeatedly about what has been going on the last few years in the district. So when you do that, when you know what you want to achieve, then your investments need to reflect that. So you can develop a budget that reflects we're going to support all children can read proficiently, and what other operational costs you need. That means you need to train teachers. That means you might need to have a par in the room with the teacher based on class size. And then your reading and test scores should be able to reflect whether that investment is paying off.
You know, Joyce, as we continue to go into this really invaluable document that you have really taken a lot of time and thought in putting together, I kind of gave access to this document to one high-ranking MPS official last week. and they were very much impressed with it. So clearly, you know of what you speak, and so as we, you know, the real problem with this information and what it is we're talking about is that it's so much of it, and we can only, you know, disseminate so much of it in any one given moment, and we've kind of reached the limit for today. But you'll be back again. We'll be back again next week, and continue to unravel this, what I think is really, really important information. And I do hope that those in power and in charge of the district take a look at this and hopefully invite you to come and sit down with your vast knowledge of all of these things, because at the root of straightening out what has been a can of worms is this institutional knowledge that you have and that you've been able to put together.
Yeah, I think it's to me, it is really about making sure that children of color are learning and achieving and thriving in school. And just like we talked about voting rights, you know, our kids, the only thing that's good with all of the dismantling of things that provided supports and helped us overcome some of the inequities and discrimination that historically we have faced and had to deal with since the end of slavery, is education. Education is the one thing that gets us through to the other side. And if we don't have that pathway, and if we don't have those skills, we need to make sure that every child has an opportunity to decide for him or herself what they want to be, and the help, the support, the love, and the care needs to be there to make that possible. We, as I said previously, we beat the enthusiasm, the interest, and the love out of some of our children, but particularly our boys. And so we need to make sure that what we are doing intentionally, that we know it will work, and that we give children and their parents hope and a belief that things will be better for them than it was for us.
Hey, Joyce, thank you very much as always. And we'll catch up again in the next segment.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You as well.